Dear Lord, we thank you for this time that we've set aside to study your holy word. And we pray that as we continue looking at the book of Joshua in this session tonight, that you'll move amongst us by the power and presence of your Holy Spirit to help us take in the teachings that you would have for us and the things that you would have us to meditate on and things that might help us, inspire us, make us more knowledgeable, or reinvigorate our faith and our witness. And we pray all these things in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen. Okay.
Virginia may need an extra one dust.
And
Jim Linda need one, I guess.
How many do
I
we
have
need?
One. I have a fan.
Well,
but I'm not really cold.
I just need this
one. I mean hot. I tell you, they keep those blankets rigid temperatures. Oh, it's terrible. And they don't pass out blankets anymore. I asked her and she said, we don't have any. Not on American. Not on Southwest.
Well,
not on Southwest. Absolutely not. No pillows.
I'm not sure how clean it was in
America. Yeah, but in court in a storm, and they're really cold.
Okay, here's five, so.
The one on the way back, not so much. For
first thing is necessary.
And I did turn it off, but the first one, I did not get one. I was really
into it.
This is the new one. That's the new one.
Okay. Alrighty. So, we're looking at session 27, which is the first bullet we covered last time, which is all the geography. We tried to cover that pretty thoroughly, and looking at how it kind of separates up the land by the Arnon River, which is a river that runs into the Dead Sea at one of the lowest points on Earth. And then we have Mount Hermon, which is in the north, which is one of the highest peaks on Earth. Certainly not compared to Mount Everest or anything like that, but I mean it is a snow-capped mountain, almost 10,000 feet. So you kind of go from one of the highest highs to the lowest place on Earth, and then we're looking at the fact that as we're sitting here in chapter 12, it's a recap. And in this recap, it really emphasizes the fact that from north to south, from the highest point to the lowest point, all on the east side of the Jordan River, what they had done in defeating these two kings, Sihon and Og, these two giants. These were these perverted hybrid creatures that were very powerful, and they had big armies, and they were in the way of Joshua and Israel crossing over the Jordan, which God had commanded them to do. So the way we analogize that to our lives is, you know, for each Christian there should be hopefully a crossing the Jordan moment. And right up until that point, or right before that happens, or right when it's happening, there's likely to be a lot of supernatural resistance from the enemy. Because as soon as the Christian crosses the Jordan in their life, that's kind of the symbolic moment where you become, you have the potential to then become an effective Christian. Okay, there's lots of Christians. There's a lot of people in the world. There's less Christians than there are total people in the world. Agreed? Obviously, right? Mm-hmm. So, now, out of the Christians that are in the world, there's a lot of Christians, but there's a lot less effective Christians that are moving forward with the gospel, for the cause of the gospel, and living their lives in a way that helps spread the gospel and helps support the fellowship. So, you know, that hopefully most Christians have had, you know, some real struggle challenges in their lives. And we kind of, that's contrary to what we think naturally speaking, right? You know, naturally speaking, we want everything to be smooth sailing and nice and easy. But as Christians, really, we should prefer the challenges. You know, we should, when we have a challenge, when we have a difficulty, it's an opportunity for spiritual growth. If you've already attained that spiritual growth and now you're trying to spread the gospel to others, and you encounter resistance, you know, Jesus says, you know, that's kind of like the capstone of blessings of the Beatitudes. He said, blessed are you when, you know, people say all kinds of things falsely about you for my sake, and blessed are you, you know, when you're persecuted for the sake of the gospel. I'm paraphrasing, of course, but, you know, those are the last two of the Beatitudes. It's kind of like the highest, you've reached the highest level if you're getting to that point. So before crossing the Jordan, in our lives, metaphorically, we're bound to encounter some heavy resistance. And in right here in Joshua chapter 12, it reiterates that, and it kind of calls our attention back to the fact that was a big battle too, and that was kind of the battle that where Moses was still a part of it. And it goes back to Numbers 21:21-35, which we read last time, and then Deuteronomy 2, chapter 2, verse 8-3:29, which we're going to read tonight. And this gives a more detailed account. So this is a long passage, so I think we can split it up into maybe give, let's just do it in a way so everybody gets a chance here to read. Because these are pretty long chapters here. So, as you're going there, I'm just going to real quick read you the passage in Joshua that we're cross-referencing here, which is Joshua chapter 12, verses 2 through 6, where it says, Sihon, king of the Amorites, who lived in Heshbon, ruled from Aroer, which is on the edge of the valley of Arnon, that's the river we just talked about, both the middle of the valley and half of Gilead, even as far as the brook Jabbok, and the border of the sons of Ammon. Okay, and then remember, Ammonites were the result of the incestuous relationship between Lot and his one of his daughters. Then it says, and the Arabah, now that's that Jordan River Valley. The Arabah is the Jordan River Valley, and it goes all the way down below from where, even below where Israel borders are, all the way to the Gulf of whatever it's called, Aqaba, yeah. And then it goes all the way up to Mount Hermon, this Jordan River Valley. And it includes things like the Jordan River, obviously. It includes the Salt Sea, and it includes the Sea of Galilee. So this, it's like a valley. There's mountains on this side, there's mountains on this side, and then there's kind of a valley right down the middle. So, that's what that is. And as far as the Sea of Chinneroth, that's Galilee, toward the east, and as far as the Sea of the Arabah, the Salt Sea, eastward toward Beth Jeshimoth, and on the south, the foot of the slopes of Pisgah, and the territory of Og, king of Bashan, one of the remnant of the Rephaim, who lived at Ashtaroth and at Edrei, and ruled over Mount Hermon, and Saleka, and all Bashan, as far as the border of Geshurites, and the Maacathites, and half of Gilead, the border of Sihon, king of Heshbon. Moses, the servant of the Lord, and the sons of Israel defeated them, and Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave it to the Reubenites, and the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh as a possession. Okay, so that's the passage in Joshua. It's a recap. And so now we're just going to kind of go back and look at the details of when that happened and how it happened. Keep in mind, as we start here on Deuteronomy, we want to be sensitive to the fact that this is Deuteronomy and Joshua. Chronologically, they're very close. Okay, it's like Deuteronomy happens, and Deuteronomy is a really long book. But the entire thing of Deuteronomy happens in the course of a couple of days or weeks. Okay, because all it is a long series of sermons of Moses recapping everything that happened. Okay, it's just a recap of everything that happened. And then he gives that recap right before he dies, and then he hands over the five books, the Torah, he hands that over to Joshua, and then Joshua takes over. And that's when we started Joshua. So we've been through all these battles and all these kings, and we know that 7 years have gone by, right? But during this recap in Joshua, it's recapping things that happened only, you know, only 7, 8, 9 years ago, really. So it's this is recent history. The people that this is speaking to and it's recapping to originally, you know, they physically remember these events. So, all right. So let's jump in here and let's look at start on Deuteronomy chapter 2, verse 8. And Mom, would you take 8 through, let's say, 12?
Okay. So we bypassed our brothers, the descendants of Esau, who live in Seir. We turned away from the Arabah road and from Eloth and Ezion-Geber. We traveled along the road to the wilderness of Moab. The Lord said to me, show no hostility toward Moab, and do not provoke them to battle, for I will not give you any of their land as a possession, since I have given Ar as a possession to the descendants of Lot. The Emim, a great and numerous people as tall as the Anakim, had previously lived there. They were also regarded as Rephaim, like the Anakim, though the Moabites called them Emim. The Horites had previously lived to Seir, but the descendants of Esau drove them out, destroying them completely and settling in their place, just as Israel did in the land of its possession the Lord gave them.
All right. So it's talking about the Emim, the Anakim, the Rephaim. These are all the giants. Okay? And I got a splash water here.
Yeah,
I got one here. If you see him land, just let me know. We'll get him.
He landed on my nose.
John, don't tell him that. He'll get it.
For the good of the team. Make one for the team.
Do a frog bit here.
All right, so... But we no, it's okay. If you see him, just holler. And we'll,
if it's your pen, I don't want to bother.
Ladies with your pants.
He's getting me right now. I got it right here.
I guess it's right here.
It just landed on Dustin's face.
Here, let me get it.
No, we'll wait till it lands on me.
Okay.
All right. So we have you know, all these giants. These are the weird offspring of the human women and the fallen angels who went after Lucifer. Okay, so let's continue on now and see what happens next. Verses 13 through, say, 20 or 21.
And the Lord said, now get up and cross the Arid Valley. So we crossed the valley. 38 years passed from the time we left Kadesh Barnea until we crossed the Zered Valley. By then, that entire generation of fighting men had perished from the camp, as the Lord had sworn to them. The Lord's hand was against them until he had completely eliminated them from the camp. Now when the last of these fighting men among the people had died, the Lord said to me, today you are to pass by the region of Moab at Ar. When you come to the Ammonites, do not harass them or provoke them to war, for I will not give you possession of any land belonging to the Ammonites, and have given it as a possession to the descendants of Lot. That, too, was considered a land of the Rephaites, who used to live there, but the Ammonites called them Zamzumites. They were a people strong and numerous and as tall as the Anakites. The Lord destroyed them from before the Ammonites, who drove them out and settled in their place.
All right. And you know, so again, now we're talking about Moab, right? So just think about this for a minute. Remember, we have Abraham and Lot, right? Remember, Abraham and Lot. And so Lot kind of tags along with Abraham, right? And then Lot ends up going to Sodom and Gomorrah to dwell there. And Abraham stays, you know, kind of in that general central region of what became Israel. And when that happened, you know, Lot actually gets captured. If you remember, there's this War of the Kings. You remember their names? Mm-hmm. Who's their name?
Abraham defeated them and gave them his tithes.
The names of the four kings?
Yeah, I don't remember.
Oh, you don't know?
No, I know, but I can't remember them.
Well,
Amraphel,
who's the king of Elam, Shinar, that's Iraq, present-day Iraq. It's Arioch, king of Elisar, we don't really know where that is. It's Chedorlaomer, the king of Elam, that's Persia, that's modern-day Iran. And then it's this title, king of Goyim, which is like a kind of a root word for kind of like Gentiles. Kind of indicates that title was like the kind of like the big king over them all. Bless you. And
derogative word from Jewish for Gentile.
Sure. It means basically uninitiated, is what it means. It kind of like you're the ones who are out of the loop. You're the ones who are, you know. So it is a derogatory term. It's used in a lot of secret circles, actually, even in modern times. Goyim. It means kind of like, you know, the uninitiated dummies. Like, oh, well, they're just the Goyim. You know, we're the special, you know, but they're just the Goyim.
Every Jewish household needs a Goyim.
Is that why you keep calling me a Goyim?
You didn't talk like that when you were married, did you?
No, but I
to be on the inside.
She picked it up from her in-laws, though. She can imitate them perfectly.
I'm teaching Donald Clubs and what to say during his class.
All right. Well, we have those four kings, right?
These kings came,
and guess what they did? They actually, it says, the scripture in Genesis chapter 14, it says they came and they wiped out most of the Rephaim, the Eman, the Zamzumin, and the Horites. Those same ones that we just read about, those big four kings, right? They're the big kings of the land. They come and they wipe those guys out. They wipe out the Amalekites. They wipe out the Amorites. Then they come and they defeat the king of Sodom and Gomorrah, the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah. And did you get him?
Yep.
All right.
You are good.
You win the prize. You get an extra bag of pears.
Who is that, Mr. Miyagi?
I think
it's
Thou shalt not kill.
No, there's a bunch of exceptions there.
Yeah.
One of them
doesn't apply to vermin. All right, so we got those, you know, so these are impressive kings, right? Impressive kings. They defeat all these giants, and they defeat this whole land, and they kind of take, you know, they take out the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah, and Admah and Zeboim and Zoar. And they're all, you know, having this big victory. And they carry off the people of Sodom and Gomorrah as captives, including Lot. So, powerful, right? Well, guess what? Abraham, with 318 of his household servants, you know, Abraham was a wealthy guy. He had an entourage. He had, you know, he was a pretty powerful dude, but he's only 318 strong. While they're going back, these four kings are going back to their homelands, you know, Persia, like Iraq, you know, basically modern-day Iraq and Iran, they're going back. He comes, sneaks up on them, overpowers them, takes Lot and all the possessions they took away from them, and comes back to Israel and brings it back. And that's where he first meets Melchizedek and gives the first tithe. And Melchizedek is called the king and priest of God Most High, and he brings out bread and wine for the first time. So you kind of get that immediate symbolism of Christ right there at the very beginning in the opening chapters of Genesis. All right, so anyway, this kind of mirrors that very well, but you see the reason I brought that up is because of Lot, right? So Lot, unfortunately, decides to go back to Sodom and Gomorrah after he's rescued, and the people just go from bad to worse, and they become very deplorable. And then Sodom and Gomorrah gets destroyed, and so what happens to Lot is he and his two daughters, those are the only ones that are left, because his wife, remember, she turns to a pillar of salt, so the other people in his household laughed at him, and they didn't think that he was serious. So really, that just ends up being Lot and his two daughters, and that's it. So they run to the hills, right? And they're there, kind of, you know, up in the hills, and they see Sodom and Gomorrah and the whole landscape. All they can see is just fire and brimstone. And so you got to remember that at the time of Abraham, when Abraham was first born, depending on how you do the chronology, there's two different ways you can do the chronology. But either way, the time that Abraham was born, it's possible that Noah was still alive. If you go back and you do all the math. So with Noah still being alive, or at the worst, Noah had just died a couple of years before Abraham was born. Okay, so my point being, cataclysmic worldwide destruction was still on everybody's mind, right? You know, they still were kind of recovering from the fact that they had just started re-establishing themselves, they had just started repopulating the earth. All these things had just started a couple of generations ago. And, you know, we have this worldwide devastation that had just happened. And so when Lot's daughters see the landscape in ruins, you know, what they did is not justifiable. However, we can kind of at least have a little bit of compassion for them, because what their thinking was, and you can get this from the scripture, Genesis chapter 19 and 20, they were thinking that they were the only ones left on earth, just like they were thinking they were the new Noah, you know. That now, you know, the world had been destroyed before, and now it had been destroyed again, and if there was going to be any offspring, the only way, you know, well, there's one man, and there's two of us, and, you know, it's not a very pleasant story, but they get their father Lot inebriated, and one night, you know, the one stern, and the other night's the other stern, and they both do that, and that's where these two peoples come from, the Moabites and the Ammonites. They come from Lot's daughters having subversive sexual relationship with their father. But remember, it's because they thought there was nobody left. As far as they knew, everything was destroyed again. So, so that maybe kind of helps, you know, put them in a little bit better light than usually when reading the story, because it reads pretty ugly. So, just keep that in mind, that you have the Ammonites, the Moabites, and keep in mind here that God specifically tells the Israelites they're off limits. So these people, the Ammonites and the Moabites, even though they would become Israel's enemies, and God knew that they would be their enemies, He still blesses them and allows them to continue on and have their own land and continue to grow. Despite the questionable, their questionable origins. And at one point, Ruth, the Moabitess, who's from here, ends up becoming intertwined into the genealogy of Christ, along with Rahab, who we discussed earlier in Joshua. So, just keep in mind that God has this plan. And part of his plan includes the Moabites and the Ammonites. You might also notice that Esau is mentioned a little bit earlier, and Esau becomes the Edomites, and they are also known as the Idumeans. Okay, so the Edomites or Idumeans, they are the ones, the Idumeans are the ones where Herod comes from. Okay, remember Herod the Great? He was an Idumean. In other words, he's close to, he is a descendant of Abraham. And, you know, there is this kind of, just like we had with the Israelites and the Samaritans, you know, at Jesus' time, they had similar ancestry, right? But there was a sharpness to their bitterness against each other. You know, sometimes close family relations can have a sharp divide at some point. And, you know, the Israelites and the Samaritans, they were pretty bitter against each other because of past family situations in history. So just like Jacob and Esau, remember the situation there? You know, Jacob kind of plays his little tricks, and you know, not that excuses the behavior of Esau either, but Jacob plays his little tricks, and Esau comes out on the short end of the stick. And so that there you have Jacob becomes Israel, and Esau becomes Edom, or the Idumeans. So you have these three peoples, the Moabites, the Ammonites, and the Edomites, and they're all kind of right around the borders of Israel. And God tells them, you can't touch their land. It doesn't belong to you. And even though they're going to be your enemies, you know, God still kind of deals with them at the same time. And they do have some common ancestry. You know, Abraham is really the relative of all of them, ultimately. Okay, so moving on from there, let's pick it up with verse 22, I believe. Okay. 22 through 25.
Things haven't changed much, have they? All those relatives are still at war with each other.
Oh, yeah.
The Lord had done the same for the descendants of Esau, who lived in Seir, when he destroyed the Horites from before them. They drove them out and have lived in their place to this day. And as for the Avites, who lived in villages as far as Gaza, the Kaphtorites, coming out from Kaphtor, destroyed them and settled in their place. Set out now and cross the Arnon Gorge. See, I have given into your hand Sihon and Amorite, king of Heshbon, and his country. Begin to take possession of it and engage him in battle. This very day I will begin to put the terror and fear of you on all the nations under heaven. They will hear reports of you and will tremble and be in anguish because of you.
All right. And the verse 23 there, where he talks about the Evan living in the villages as far as Gaza, the Kaphtorim, you know who those people are? No, it's the Philistines. That's the Philistines.
I'm not keeping up
very good. We're in Deuteronomy chapter 2, verse 23.
Deuteronomy chapter 2. No, we're on the new one that you got.
Oh, you're on the new one? Yeah.
27.
Okay, so verse chapter 2, verse 23 on Deuteronomy. The Kaphtorim, that's the Philistines. And boy, you know, your comment was very appropriate because talk about relevant to today. These are the ancestors of who are now called the Palestinians, you know, are these people. And so many people have it completely wrong. They think it's a big Arab. They believe it's a big Arab thing with Ishmael. The Philistines aren't Arab. Kaphtorim, that's from Mizraim, from Ham. Mizraim was Ham's second born. And Mizraim is Egypt. So Mizraim, Egypt, you know, we go from Ham, right? Ham, Mizraim, that's a person. Mizraim is a person. Ham's second born. And that's the person who came and founded the area we now know as Egypt. Okay? And then that Mizraim person who founded Egypt, he has six sons, the fifth of which is Kaphtorim. You can get all this in Genesis chapter 10. So Kaphtorim is the forefather of the Philistines. It even says so in Genesis chapter 10. It explicitly states that, to make it clear. So the Kaphtorim here, these are the Philistines. And notice where they're in? Gaza. You know, talk about front page news, right? All right, so let's move on. 26 through 31. Joe?
So I sent messengers from the ruler of Kedemoth to Shihon, king of Hebron, with words of peace, saying, let me pass through your land. I will travel only on the highway. I will not turn aside to the right or to the left. You will sell me food for money so that I may eat, and give me water for money so that I may drink. Only let me pass through on foot. Just as the son of Esau who lived in Seir, and the Moabites who lived in Ar, did for me until I crossed over the Jordan into the land which the Lord our God is giving to us. The Shihon, king of Heshbon, was not willing for us to pass through his land, for the Lord your God hardened his spirit and made his heart obstinate, yeah, in order to deliver him into your hand as he is today. And the Lord said to me, see, I have begun to deliver Shihon in his hand over to you. Begin to occupy that you may possess the land.
All right, thank you. All right, so here Moses gives this king here kind of a peace treaty, kind of an option, right? Kind of a, you know, we're heading over the Jordan. All we ask of you is, you know, let us pass through unabated. We're going to, you know, we're not going to steal anything. We're not going to take anything without paying for it. We just want to march straight on through and go to what, where God has told us to go. Not willing. So they need to be wiped out. And I believe the same dynamic exists for us as Christians. If you're trying to cross the Jordan, metaphorically speaking, in your Christian walk, and you tell Satan, well, I want to cross the Jordan. I want to get to the next level of my Christianity. I want to, you know, really get empowered and be filled with the Holy Spirit for useful purpose. You know, I just have to kind of make it through this last little bit of territory here that is kind of in your jurisdiction. So will you please let me do that, Satan? And what do you think the answer is going to be?
No.
Absolutely not. You know, no way. And not only is it going to be no way, it's going to be, I'm going to put up fierce resistance in your way of trying to do this. And so we see that happen here on the Sihon side of things. And let's finish reading what happens there. Brenda, you want to take 32 through 37?
Then Sihon and all his people came out against us to fight at Jahaz. And the Lord our God delivered him over to us, so we defeated him, his sons, and all his people. We took all his cities at that time, and we utterly destroyed the men, women, and little ones of every city. We left none remaining. We took only the livestock as plunder for ourselves, with the spoil of the cities which we took from Aroria, which is on the bank of the river Arnon, and from the city that is in the ravine as far as Gilead. There was not one city too strong for us. The Lord our God delivered all to us. Only we did not go near the land of the people of Ammon, anywhere along the river to Chevron misfortune, the cities of the mountains, or where the Lord our God has forgiven us.
All right, thank you. So they wipe out Sihon and his armies. And it's shortly after this, it's shortly after that this happens that, you know, the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half tribe of Manasseh, it's shortly after this that they say, hey, you know, this land that we conquered here, this is pretty good stuff. It's perfect for us. Why can't we just go ahead and stay here and keep this instead? And that's where Moses says, you know, after he consults with God, he then says, okay, it's okay if you do that, but you have to cross the Jordan with us, fight the battles, then you can come back and settle here, right? Okay, so then it's chapter 3, verse 1. Virginia, would you read verses 1 through 8? Or nine.
Okay. Then we turned and went up the road to Bashan. And Og, the king of Bashan, came out against us, he and all his people, to battle at Edrei. And the Lord said to me, do not fear him, for I have delivered him and all his people and his land into your hands. You shall do to him as you did to Sihon, king of the Amorites, who dwelt in Heshbon. So the Lord our God also delivered into our hands Og, king of Bashan, and all the people, and we attacked him until he had no survivors remaining. And we took all his cities. At that time, there was not a city which we did not take from them. 60 cities, all the regions of Argob, the kingdom of Og in Bashan. And all these cities were fortified with high walls, gates, and bars, besides a great many rural towns. And we utterly destroyed them, as we did to Sihon, king of Heshbon, utterly destroying the men, women, and children of every city. But all the livestock and the spoil of the cities we took as booty for ourselves. And at that time we took the land from the hand of the two kings of the Amorites who were on this side of the Jordan, from the river Arnon to Mount Hermon. The Sidonians called Hermon Sirion, and the Amorites called it Senor.
All right. And just finish up the last three verses there, sorry, or two verses, 10 and 11.
Okay. All the cities of the plains, all Gilead and all Bashan as far as Salca and Edrei, cities of the kingdom of Og in Bashan. For only Og, king of Bashan, remained of the remnant of the giants. Indeed, his bedstead was an iron bedstead. Is it not in Rabbah of the people of Ammon? 9 cubits is its length, and 4 cubits its width, according to the standard cubit.
Thank you. All right, so here, talking about Og here. Now, Og's on the north. You know, Sihon was kind of on the set from the south.
This is just a review, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because all of this has already happened.
Yeah, exactly. So it's Joshua 12 is just a big recap. It's a recap before they start allocating the land to all the tribes. They just kind of take a breath, and they say, this is how we got here. And I think that's a good idea for us as Christians. You know, there might be current trials, struggles, persecutions, difficulties that we each face, some new challenges every year, maybe every month. But I think it's a good idea as Christians, not too much, because you don't want to rest on your laurels. That's dangerous. Resting on your laurels creates kind of a complacency and a, you know, yeah, that too, pride, and it kind of creates a not moving forward and a I've arrived attitude. But with good measure, you know, and in appropriate amounts, I think it's good to, when you're facing these new challenges and you're facing difficult circumstances that are coming up, maybe with a boss, maybe with a family member, maybe with somebody falsely accusing me, maybe somebody betraying me, maybe a difficult problem with a friend, or maybe a difficult medical situation, whatever it is. You know, we're dealing with all these various things. It's a good idea to sit back and reflect on how numerous are the prayers that God has previously answered and brought you through time and time and time again all these previous trials. If you remember, oh, you know, God got me through that. I remember, you know, it might even be neat to just kind of, I'm not much of a journal type person, but some people are. And if you're a Christian and you keep a journal, you know, it'd be a good idea to throw in the, well, I was really, really struggling with this. Seemed like a monumental thing that I was never going to get past. And then with prayer and patience and just keeping on one foot in front of the other, you know, those walls, whatever they were, the insurmountable walls came crumbling down just like Jericho. And in retrospect, it's easy to look back and forget how big that used to seem when you were on the previous side of it. But once God got you through to the other side, you kind of look back and say, oh, yeah, that was nothing. And yeah, well, it was nothing, but it was nothing because God got you through it. And so I think it's a good idea for us to take inventory of all the things that God has gotten us through, because I think what it does is it helps build our faith for those times when the next time we're faced with something that seems like a huge insurmountable challenge, we can go back and remember, well, I felt like that before and God got me through it. I felt like that before and God got me through it here. And you know, there's new challenges all the time, and I think God likes, you know, I think God gives special favor to those who take that attitude. You know, it's the attitude that King David had. You know, he was always up for the next challenge. You know, he was always up for the next, you know, victory. He was always, you know, ready to improve. And Josh was like that, and Caleb's like that. As we're going to find out in chapter 13, Caleb, a real good example in Caleb. Obviously, Jesus was like that. And then he called his apostles, his disciples who became the apostles, he called them to be like that too. So certainly something we should consider as we take inventory of our own lives and try to move forward with victories.
Interesting that as you go through the Old Testament and even into the New Testament somewhat, of how many times it's written that, you know, the Lord delivered you, you know, in Exodus across the Red Sea, part of the Red Sea. How many times do you read that throughout, you know, kept constantly reminding the Jews, you know, as you go through the Old Testament leading up to the New Testament. Over and over and over again, you hear that.
Yeah.
You know, Psalms. And
more justification right there. It's in the Old Testament that God condones, not only condones it, but commands it, that we remember. You know, we need to remember that, you know, not just what happened to them and what happened in the history, but also in our own lives. We need to look back and remember how God has gotten us from here to here, and then from here to here, and from here to here, and so on. It's a progression. And as we reflect on that, I think it can be a faith building. I think it can help us say, well, you know what? This big, nasty situation I'm facing right now, it's actually, you know, let me just unsheathe my sword here and get down to business and get through it, right? And I mean, that's Caleb's attitude for sure. You know, Caleb, he was ready to roll. Joshua too. So it's a good attitude to have. All right. So now looking on verse 12 through 17, Carol.
Then we took possession of this country from Aroer on the Wadi Arnon to the Reubenites and the Gadites. I gave half of the highlands to Gilead with his towns.
Would you please repeat all of that? No, I'm kidding. No, I'm kidding. I was just saying those were a bunch of... Go ahead.
Okay. No. To the half-tribe of Manasseh, I gave the rest of Gilead and the whole of Bashan, Og's kingdom, the whole confederation of Argob, and the whole of Bashan is called the country of Rephaim, since Jair, son of Manasseh, occupied the whole confederation of Argob as far as the frontiers of the Geshurites and the Mechathites after him. Bashan is called the encampment of Jair, even today. To Mashir, I gave Gilead. To the Reubenites and the Gadites, I gave the region from Gilead to Wadi Arnon, the middle of the ravine, marking the boundary as up as far as the Jabbok, the ravine marking the frontier of the Ammonites. The Arabah and the Jordan serves as frontiers to the Kinneret down to the Sea of the Arabah, the Salt Sea, and the foot of the slopes, Peshgah on the east.
All right,
sorry.
Thank you.
You did a beautiful job.
Yeah, that was a tough one right there. She got the tough sledding done for you.
Look at the map,
Linda. All right, so again, it's just talking about how now they've wiped out Og, and they've taken possession of all that stuff, and it's going to go to those tribes of Israel. All right, so next, we're going to 329, so we're almost there. Let's look at 18 through 20. 20?
I commanded you at that time, the Lord your God has given you this land to take possession of it. But all your able-bodied men, armed for battle, must cross over ahead of the other Israelites. However, your wives, your children, and your livestock, I know you have much livestock, may stay in the towns I have given you until the Lord gives rest to your fellow Israelites as he had to you, and they too have taken over the land that the Lord your God is giving them across the Jordan. After that, each of you may go back to the possession I have given you.
Alright, thank you. Alright, so that's talking about what we just mentioned. Remember the, you know, the those three tribes who were going to stay on the other side, or two and a half tribes, who were going to stay on the other side? Mm-hmm. God says, okay, you can do that, but you got to go fight with the rest of the Israel, or you can come back. But you can leave your families here and your livestock here while they wait for you to return. So that was a deal that they struck with God through Moses, and God holds them to it. You know, so one thing you got to be careful of, you make deals with God. God's really good at keeping his end of deals. Us, not so much. They make that deal, and God makes, he says, okay. But you got to understand is when they went back on the other side of the Jordan, they were right on the border of all their of all the enemies of Israel. So they were the first ones that fell to idolatry, pagan practices, and enemy attacks from much later on, Assyria. You know, they're the first ones that took the hit. So, you know, you got to be careful. That old adage, you know, be careful what you wish for, because it might not be ultimately the best thing in the really long term. All right, Jim, you want to take over 21 through say 25?
Okay. At that time, I commanded Joshua, and have seen with you. You have seen with your own eyes all that the Lord your God has done to those two kings. the Lord will do the same to all the kingdoms over there where you are going. Do not be afraid of them. The Lord your God himself will fight for you. At that time, I pleaded with the Lord, Sovereign Lord, you have begun to show to your servant your greatness and your strong hand. For what God is there in heaven or on earth who can do the deeds and mighty works you do? Let me go over and see the good land beyond the Jordan, that fine hill country and Lebanon.
All right. And then this is Moses speaking now, because remember it's a recap, right? It's a summary of everything that happened. And so here's God's answer to Moses, and John, you want to finish it off?
But the Lord was angry with me on your account and would not listen to me. So the Lord said to me, Enough of that. Speak no more to me of this matter. Go up to the top of Pisgah and lift your eyes toward the west, the north, the south, and the east. Behold it with your eyes, for you shall not cross over the Jordan. But command Joshua and encourage him and strengthen him, for he shall go over before his people, and he shall cause them to inherit the land which you will see. So we stayed in the valley opposite Beth Peor.
All right. And I really love this passage here because it really speaks to the strong metaphor of what Moses represented. Ultimately, Moses came to represent the law. He's synonymous with the law. In fact, it's called the law
of Moses.
Right? And so as Moses becomes identified more and more and more with the law, what we get is a really wonderful picture here of the fact that the law can't get you across the Jordan. Moses was able to bring them up to that point, but who's the only person who can get you to the other side? That's Jesus himself, our Joshua. He's the one that can lead us across to start having spiritual victory. It's not going to be on account of keeping the law. So really what the law does, more than any other thing, the law helps us to realize that we are its violators. That's really what it does. I mean, the law, clearly in the New Testament, as Paul so eloquently illustrates, that the law is put there for us to recognize the sin inside of ourselves. That is the number one purpose of the law, for us to recognize the sin inside of ourselves, which is the number one prerequisite to becoming a Christian. You can't recognize the sin inside yourself and your natural tendencies for sinful motives, sinful nature, selfish desires, selfish greedy things, lustful, contrary things to God's laws and God's perfection, then you're never going to be a Christian if you can't come to that. So, what the law can't do, notice how close the law can get. Moses tried to keep the law and he tried to be a good leader and he tried to do the very, very best that he could. And notice how, he got right up to the point where, he could kind of like look over the edge and he could see it. It got you right up to that point, but you can't go over without Jesus. And that's why God puts his foot down here and says no, because there's a greater teaching here, Moses. I know you've been my servant. You've done all this. You've done everything I've asked. But there's a greater thing that I'm going to be accomplishing through what I started with you. And that's going to really, the point's going to really be driven home for people like us sitting here in this room tonight, Moses. It's going to be really strike home for them when they recognize that they likewise cannot do anything in their lives that's spiritually valuable without Christ, the Messiah, taking them over to the other side. So you can't go over, Moses. You can't do it. You can see it, but you're not going to be the one to do it. So, real beautiful metaphor there for how the law cannot, keeping the law, can't equal spiritual, it can't equal salvation, it can't equal spiritual victory, it can't do anything other than teach us about our sinful selves. That's what it can do. Reading this, what I wrote here on the bullet, it just says, from the end of the wilderness wanderings to the victory over Sihon and Og, the staging area on the east of the Jordan, to cross over the Jordan and take full possession of everything God had promised them. So this is kind of like the staging area. And the enemy doesn't make it easy for them because there's these two powerful kings that are there in their way. But God helps them have victory over that. Then he takes them over the Jordan, and that's when they do all the stuff that we've already covered from Joshua chapter 1 to chapter 11. Okay, real quick, one verse. Matthew 16:18. I think this is appropriate for us. And I'll just read this one. It's one verse. Okay. And this is Jesus responding to Peter after he makes his great proclamation. He says, "And I also say to you that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not overpower it." Okay, so remember the rock, as Protestant Christians, we believe that the rock that Jesus is telling Peter about is the great statement of faith that he just made. Okay? That great statement where he said, you know, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. You're the Messiah. You're the Savior. And Jesus says, you know, yes, Peter, based on that statement, I'm going to build my church. And so, when that happens, Christ follows that up by saying, and the gates of Hades, or the gates of hell, will not prevail against it. And that's really interesting because, you know, I think a lot of Christians get that backwards, and they have this backwards understanding of the dynamic between the forces of good and the forces of evil. You know, we're on the enemy's home field, but even though we're on the enemy's home field, we have the advantage. And gates never, ever in all of the history of warfare have ever been an offensive weapon. You don't take your soldiers and march to your enemy's camp and then build, you know, take, you know, 3 weeks and build a gate right there. Right, you know, right on the border of your, no. That's where those people's gate is. If you get my meaning. You see that? You follow me? And what Jesus is talking about here is that Satan and his evil forces, they're the ones who have these fortresses. We are the, on the offensive, we are the ones breaking those gates down. It's not the gates will not prevail against it. It's not like, you know, we're there and Satan's, you know, attacking us and we're like, the gates might... These gates are not going to come down. No, it's talking about Satan's gates. It's talking about his walls, his fortress, his domain. We are the ones who are encroaching on his territory, not the other way around. Okay, or at least that's the dynamic that Christ intended when he said this. Maybe in modern times, unfortunately, we've regressed to some degree in that dynamic. But if you just read this bullet with me here, I say Sihon and Og represent the gateway to the promised land. Remember? From the top to the bottom, north to south, you know, the whole crossing the Jordan was blocked by these people. Okay? So who's on the offensive? Joshua. Who's our Joshua? Jesus. You know, who's on the offensive? Jesus. And who's on the offensive with him? His apostles and disciples, which includes us. You know, and he's the one taking us across And we are going to be victorious if we're in line with him and we're have our motivations and our attitude about carrying the cause of the gospel forward. And we're the ones who already have the victory. We're assured of victory and continuing victory in all the little battles that we might have. So Israel had to defeat them before they could cross the Jordan, and they stood as supernaturally empowered evil forces. Why do I say that? Well, because they were these giants. They were these giants that were the wicked offspring of fallen angels and human women. So
why could they have been female offspring,
well,
angels?
The Bible never mentions that.
Female angels.
I know that's what you see in the curio shops, but I mean, biblically speaking, there's only three angels that are mentioned by name, and that's Gabriel, Michael, and Lucifer himself. So only three angels are named by name. And angels, you know, and there's an indication from Christ himself that says, you know, well, in heaven you're not going to marry or be given in marriage. You're going to be like the angels, indicating that there's no need for procreation, physical procreation, because there is eternal being. Well, there's eternal being. You're eternal. You don't need to carry on your family line because you carry on forever. I mean, you carry on forever. There's no dying, so there's no need to, you know, carry on. So these wicked angels that came down, they took the form of men, as it says that angels can do, and Lucifer himself, it says that he can appear as an angel of light, and that angels can apparently, and that we have entertained angels unawares. In other words, angels can appear to be and function as regular, normal humans. So I believe the answer to your question is, you know, if I don't think that an angel couldn't. An angel probably could appear as a woman, but if a fallen angel came and appeared, remember, it's a satanic situation, right? So think about it. If an angel came and appeared, he would want, and he's going to commit this terrible sin that God condemns in several places in Scripture. This especially in the book of Jude, it's virulently condemned by God, and the angels who did this are in a very, very high security prison, if you will, supernatural high security prison. It says they're waiting in chains for the time of judgment, and they're in a very dark place. The fallen angels who have been captured and have been caught doing this wicked act. So, now, if you're a fallen angel and you come down to earth, you know, do you want to be, if you're going to commit this wicked act, do you want to be the dominant, you know, the dominating force in these hybrid wicked relationships? Probably, because you know, you want to be the father of, you know, if you're quote unquote this fallen angel Zeus, so to speak, you know, you want to come down and assume the physiology of the father so that you can have Hercules, your offspring, so to speak. You know, where if it was the other way around, or if it was a human father with a fallen angel taking the physiological form of a woman, then, you know, obviously it's a more powerful being taking the form of the woman, and an inferior person taking the dominant role, so to speak, as the male. So it's just my assumption, you know, that these people took, these fallen creatures took the male role because in this fallen, cursed world, physically speaking, you know, there's a more dominant aspect.
Or it could also be that the female angels didn't fall because they were perfect.
No comment. All right.
Bible's curio shops can't be wrong.
The original sin is carried through the Father. Then the fallen angels would represent the original sin, and they would
be
masculine, possibly.
That's another good point. Yeah, there is a doctrine. Most conservative Christian denominations and traditions adhere to it, and that's called the seminal transmission of sin. That meaning, in real nice language, means that the sin is carried on or perpetuated through the father, not the mother. That's how Jesus can come from a human mother, but not inherit a sin nature, because he didn't have a human father. The Holy Spirit is what conceived inside of him a perfect seed, and the human mother just passed on the human aspects of his being, minus the sin cursed seminal transmission. So that's the that is the conservative teaching. Of course, the Catholics don't like that, because that infringes on their Holy Mary-ness thing, which is, in my opinion, completely unnecessary if you understand it that way. They can make a big deal about it because they think, well, if she wasn't perfect too, then he had to inherit sin, and that's not true. It's because the sin is inherited through the Father. So he just inherited his human nature from his mother without sin.
And I think all of us would give grace to the Son of Jesus. I mean, the Mother of Jesus. I mean, we wouldn't go demeaning her in any way.
Yeah, and it's a fine line. I mean, because as Protestants, we've got to be careful not to.
Yeah.
Maybe the Catholics overdo it. But maybe as Protestants, we kind of underdo it, because, that's Mary. I mean, she bore the Son of God. I mean, that there was a time when his, being and his spirit and his flesh and everything was inside of her. And, I don't want to pretend to know all the, it was special. It's a special situation, so I don't want to pretend to be a physiological, theological expert on it, because it's a singular event. It's the only time this ever happened, ever. It's special. Just keep in mind here, Sion and Og, I think, represent, there's these gates. They seem like really intimidating, powerful nations and kings, but those gates, and I would suggest to you that the gates of hell are not this place where you go, where all these departed, I'm not thinking about it like that. I'm thinking about it like this. The gates of Hades surround people that are ensnared by the devil and his worldly way of enticing us into worldly living. And there's people in all of our families right now that have the gates of Hades surrounding them. And there's supernatural evil that set up fortresses around some of these people. In certain cases, around almost entire countries. Just think about some of these countries over there that are on the news all the time now. There's so many people that have the gates of Hades surrounding them that it's like a stronghold for an entire nation of people who've been ensnared by the devil and his schemes. But we also all probably know a friend, a couple family members here and there that have those gates of Hades surrounding them. And I think what Jesus is telling us here is, the gates of Hades will not prevail against this Satan. It. And what is it? Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. That is what the gates of Hades will not prevail against. So you know, we need to witness people Christ. And if they ultimately are his, somewhere inside of them, deep inside of them, if they belong to him, or if they're meant to belong to him, those satanic fortresses that are built up around those people will come crumbling down sooner or later, one way or another. All right, so let's move on. It talks about how Og, this guy Og, that Virginia was reading about, this guy Og, you know, he was one of these giants, and he was the king of Bashan. Let's go look at what Psalm 22 has to say about that. Most of you know Psalm 22 pretty well. It's the famous psalm that is basically the portrait of Christ on the cross, right? That this is written by, I shouldn't say written by, really it's written by Jesus. And David was supernaturally inspired to write down something that was going to happen 1,000 years from then, from when he wrote it. Okay? Because if you read Psalm 22, notice how it starts, verse 1. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Sound familiar? It's because David was prophesying what Christ would endure. Okay? So it's not, you know, and don't listen to the, you know, the skeptics. The skeptics will say, oh, well, Jesus had the psalm memorized, so he bent it to fulfill, self-fulfill the prophecy. No, because you can't force people to cast lots for your clothes. He couldn't control that situation, or a lot of these other situations. You know, he was pinned to a cross. So this is literally David prophesying 1,000 years before it happened, the crucifixion. And this is before crucifixion had ever even been invented by several hundred years.
It was a Roman.
And if you look at verse 16, it says, for dogs have surrounded me, a band of evildoers has encompassed me, they pierced my hands and my feet. You know, that's a... you know, why would you pierce somebody's hands and your feet and their feet? That doesn't make any sense unless you're crucifying them. So again, crucifixion hadn't even been invented yet as a form of execution. It had not been seen at the time of David. So, you know, this is a very prophetic psalm. It's a psalm that we say that David wrote the psalms, right? But if you really, really study the psalms carefully, every single one is either about Jesus, from Jesus himself, or some sort of reflection about what Jesus was going to do or did do. Every single psalm. It has some sort of direct messianic connection to Christ. Every single one of them. Now, there's not a single one that you cannot tie to the ministry of Christ. So, as we look at that, let's look at verses 11 through 18. And Mom, Rebecca, you, I guess?
I think John should read it.
All right.
Because he didn't get enough to read.
No, I didn't.
Well, you only read 3.
11. But not far from me, for trouble is near, but there is none to help. That's where you want me to start.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Many bulls have surrounded me. Strong bulls of Bashan have encircled me. They gape at me with their mouths like a raging and roaring lion. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax, it is melted within me. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue clings to my jaws. You have brought me to the dust of death, for dogs have surrounded me. The congregation of the wicked have enclosed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. They took and stared at me. They divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots.
All right. So the key verses here, verse 12. Many bulls have surrounded me. The strong bulls of Bashan have encircled me. What does that mean? Bulls. Like, it's the root word where we get bully from.
But also the law were considered bulls, and the people that were surrounding him were the Pharisees and Sadducees who were the law.
Possible. Yeah, another possibility. And here it says, they open wide their mouth at me as a ravening and roaring lion. You know, what I'm going to suggest here is that Bashan was known as one of the headquarters for the giants, who were ultimately ruled over by Og, the big giant that was 13 feet high and, you know, however 5 feet wide or whatever. Okay? So, Bashan was considered the headquarters or one of the strongholds of these wicked offspring. And many people, including myself, believe that when those creatures, these very powerful creatures, were defeated and killed and or died mortal deaths, that there was no place for them to go, and they became the demons that plagued the people that we hear about in the New Testament. There's a limited number of them, and there was really no place for them to go because they don't go to be with God in heaven. They don't go to the holding place of the souls of men before Christ came, that Sheol area, that Abraham's bosom area. You know, they don't go there, so there's really no place for them, so they just roam and wander about aimlessly looking for people to possess. You know, they are attracted to a host, like a parasite. And the reason I believe there's a distinction between demons and fallen angels, most pastors don't teach this, they don't think about it deeply enough, really, in my opinion, is you never see angels or fallen angels, like Satan. We know Satan was a fallen angel, right? You ever see him desperately trying to, you know, enter the pigs, or, you know, he's just a cool character. He's a cool character stroaming about, like Job. He says he's walking about here and there, to and fro on the earth, you know, observing men and seeing what's going on. You know, he has no restrictions. He's not desperately seeking embodiment like the demons are, right? We know in the New Testament the demons are desperately trying to find a host that they can be a parasitic being that takes over that living host. So what I'm going to suggest to you is these strong bulls of Bashan, that they are the demonic departed souls of the wicked Rephaim and Nephilim giants that are unseen, but are there. They're unseen by the people of the crowds, but I believe Christ perceives them and sees them. And I believe they are there for their victory song. They are there to see him beaten, you know, whipped, crucified, and so on. And they are there the whole time mocking him and you know, trying to get him to somehow go to the cross in an unworthy manner, or slip up, or do something wrong, you know, fail in some way. I believe they are there to just mock him, and just like it says here, you know, they open wide their mouth at me as a ravening and roaring lion. They're bulls, just like Og, you know. Hey, when you're 13 feet high and 5 feet wide, it's easy to be a bull. It's easy to be a bully. You know, you're going to use what your advantage is, right? That's obviously his advantage. And so, you know, he's used to being a bully. Maybe even Og himself was one of these demons that's there mocking and trying to terrorize Jesus as he was being crucified. So, I just point that out because, you know, that just sounds like poetic language, but if you go back and research Bashan and what it really was, what it really represented, it maybe, you know, just adds one more dynamic to the great feat that Christ accomplished at the cross. You know, the more you study it, I believe, the more impressive it is that he accomplished it. So there's that aspect to this, and you know, I just thought I'd share that because that's something that stuck out to me as I researched Bashan a little bit more and figured out what it was, what it represented. I believe it represents those people. If you've ever seen one of the various renditions of the Narnia story, you know, it's kind of a C.S. Lewis children's tale, but it's kind of the gospel kind of wrapped up in this, you know, story. And there's a couple of movies. There's the old BBC production, which is actually pretty well done, and the newer Hollywood one, also pretty well done. And you see this scene. Jesus is represented as a lion, and as he goes to sacrifice himself, you know, this horde of wicked, horrible-looking creatures and demons and horrible things, they just have, it's like their big party time. You know, they get to just lay into him like nothing. You know, just...
You know, when we've been reading about the giants, all the Nephilim, the Rephaim, there's a myth, a mythology among the Hawaiian peoples that their gods were huge. They were called the Ali Nui, and they were just huge people, much bigger than they were, but they were people, but they were gods also. They worshipped them, and they ruled over them. But that's in their faraway mythology, and it just, for some reason, that made me think of that.
Yeah. Well, think about Greek mythology. What is it? It's the gods coming down and mixing with humans, isn't it?
Yep. Zeus.
You have the whole Zeus, Athena, Hercules dynamic, and that happens with just about every single one of them. There's the god, which is really just what we know to be what? Fallen angel. And then there's the interaction between that god, so to speak, and humanity, and then there's this abnormal offspring. And we've dressed it all up and made them champions, like Hercules, and you think, oh, Hercules was a great, you know, probably, you know, for all we know, Hercules was Og, you know, the wicked king of Bashan, you know, for all we know. And you know, you go find Pacific Islanders, New Zealand, China, Japan, you know, every single one of them has their myth of a worldwide flood. Every single one of them has, just like you were saying, these myths of the, you know, similar to the Greek-Roman mythology. So, you know, when you have that diverse a geography and diverse peoples, and they all have the same root core myths, kind of leads back to having its roots in the truth, which the Bible, I think, you know, clearly illustrates what the real truth behind all that was.
Yeah, where there's smoke, there's fire.
All right, so if you'll notice real quick, the next bullet doesn't have a specific scripture to go to.
Oh, I thought we were going to read all.
No. I basically just sum it all up and say, you know, Joshua 12:7-23, it's just where it goes through all those kings.
Yeah.
You know, it just says the king of Jericho won, the king of Ai won, the king of whatever won, the king of this won, the king of this won, right? And it just goes through and it tallies them all up. And on the once they cross the Jordan, which is where God wanted them to be, there just happens to be 31 kings that they defeat. There's 31 kings. There's 31 primary cities that they defeat. And remember, we've been through what all those things mean, right? Like all the name meanings of all those kings and all the places where they ruled over. They all have meaning to what their names meant. And so it's just interesting to note, kind of getting off on a little side tangent here real quick. It's interesting to note that El is the root name of God, like Elohim or El Shaddai, and there's a lot of them. There's, you know, the root word for God is El in the Bible. And this is just something that came to my attention. I don't know that we make too big a deal out of it, but I think it is interesting that it just happens to have a geometrical value of 31. Okay, and gematria can be abused, so I don't want to say that it's something that you should get into and study, because it's really the basis of all the cults that get into all that Kabbalah nonsense and all that garbage. You know, and they try to go and look for, you know when it's wrong, okay? Here's when it's wrong, for sure. When people try to go find codes to get messages to how they're supposed to live their lives. Or they try to find codes and patterns that tell them secret messages, or, you know, about them or about their life or about JFK and
Da Vinci.
Whatever, okay? So, you know, whenever there's gematria and that stuff, well, hey, just guess what? That's wrong. But I think it is interesting when things, when people analyze the mathematical properties of the Bible and they find just perfect patterns that point to God and His divine authorship of it, then I think maybe there's, you know, maybe there's something to it. To be treated with caution, for sure. But just a quick note here to close on. It's interesting that the root word for God in the Bible has a geometrical value of 31. That basically means the Hebrew letter. There's two Hebrew letters that make up that word L. And those two letters each have a mathematical value to them. And when you add them together, it happens to equal the number 31. Right? 31 squared is 961. The inverse, 13, it's a superstitious number. I'm not saying that we as Christians should be superstitious of it, but notice that it's the inverse. It's the reverse of the number of God, right? 13. And many people attribute 13 to being, you know, somehow to be associated with the devil and his schemes and his mark or his number or his whatever. And if you'll notice the square of 13 is 169. So 31 squared is 961. 13 squared, 169. It's a pair of the only two numbers. There's only one other set of numbers in the entire, all of numbers that we know of, where the number and its inverse are also squared. In the square of them is also inverse. So it's kind of like a compound opposition, so to speak. It's like a compound opposition. Because it's like, you know, 31 is going this way, 13 is going the other way. And then when you square them, they're also opposed to each other. So I just found that interesting. And I find it interesting that it just so happens to be that there's exactly 31 kings that are defeated and destroyed for them to take possession of the land across the Jordan. And so I kind of look at that as, you know, there was these 31 things of all these wicked people who had replaced God with all of these pagan idolatrous practices that it talks about and that you can research on your own from secular history. And those 31 aspects or those 31 things all ultimately get defeated and get replaced with God's chosen and empowered people. So maybe making something of nothing or more of it than it should be, I don't know, but you know, it's neither here nor there. It's an interesting little piece of trivia. If you want to investigate it more for yourself, I'll leave that to you. So that's really it. The last bullet you can see there is just a copy mistake. I apologize for that. That is not meant to be there. Sorry about that one. Okay. So that is the conclusion of session 27, and we will pick it up with Joshua chapter 13.
How ironic.
Next week.
Hmm.
No superstition, no superstition.
And don't use any mathematical formula.